Our president, Nancy Dropnagel, is off somewhere else doing denominational business this weekend.
And I'm Warren Hagstrom, welcoming you on behalf of the program committee. We'll start off with Ruth Calden, a licensed
accountant. When I was a child, I was told this line from William Cullen Bryant, an American poet. All the tread reserved are but handful to those that seek and seek them. I thought about that a long time when I was a child, and today we are remembering and honoring those that we have known and loved and lost, and seek in the wisdom of the earth. And so I'm going to light the challenge for all of them. We remember how they have shaped and touched our lives. In the struggles we choose for ourselves, in the way we move forward in our lives and bring our world forward with us,
we try to remember the names of those who gave us strength in this choice of living. It is right to name the power of our lives well lived.
We share a history with those lives. We belong to the same motion.
They too were strengthened by what had gone before. They too were drawn on by the vision of what might come to be.
Those who lived before us, who struggled for justice and suffered injustice before us, have not melted into the dust and have not disappeared.
They are with us still. The lives they live hold us steady.
Their words remind us and call us back to ourselves. Their courage and love evoke our own.
We believe in living, caring, and hoping. We are their voice, their hands, and their hearts.
We take them with us, and with them, choose the deeper path of living.
Mr. Blake is going to read the children's story, and I think we would probably like it if some of the children would come out and struggle here. And in this book, we're going to do some Spanish words. My book is called The Day of the Dead. Above a small town in Mexico, the sun rises at the greatest moment. As that sun comes to the city, the children here wake up. Mama is making empanadas, little soup. That's me. The children cry now. Una pavadita. A taste. Wait, says Mama, as Brown says. So then, For weeks, Cameron has been preparing for this day. Los tíos, the uncles, have been coming. Right, Brown? The children have tried to answer you. Say the uncle, Esperante. Till then, soon. For days, Bastia, the aunt, had been grounding dry kids in the parlor. The children had been sniffing the chili powder. Wait, said Bastia. The teachers are kind of proud of this in the fact that they're delightful if you have a chance to look down the line. For days, Papa has been visiting the bakery, bringing back bowls and sandwiches. Papa says, wait. for it means Mama has baked, and the winter bread of the dead. The children have tried to sleep, and the muerto to eat. The hormiga asked, no, Mama said, not one crumb. For night up, bread. Today, Papa has cut a long line of tanya with his hand. The children try to sneak the pain that sucks their sweetness out. Way? Today, La Tia drew a pot of chocolate and jelly, a mole. They put chicken in, stirring, stirring again. The children tried to eat the mole. Schooled me in the correct pronunciation. The children come from the market with loads of marigolds. In every room, bloom marigold bouquets. Now, nothing. The family gathers all the things that are coming to this building and go out. The little procession goes walking through the street, walking over the hill, walking to the graveyard. They go dropping a path of heaven. But the spirit and the not the spirit that the ones they love to be there together. And here they go. Unwrapped his bundle. Sugar fell. The children squeal and eat his treats. So they made a treat in the shape of a doll. Now the children are just getting really wonderful.
Here's the big one behind you.
Oh, it's that one. Okay. So it might take just a moment to recognize whoever it is. Mama dresses the pound in wedges. Everyone takes the same bread. One child likes to eat. Ah! The tiny skinny skeleton. This one's alive. I guess you take a long little bread. It's clearer than that. Now it is ready. The family gathers ready to act all the things of the day. They gather cabin, dust, and jars. And they gather the people.
Their taste, they're going to go downstairs and have their religious education program, and there's child care if anyone has anyone younger than kindergarten with you today. Thank you very much, Lisa. And now we'll sing hymn number 18, What Wondrous Love. I was part of an Elder Hopsel group that was observing and studying the Day of the Dead Festival in Michoacan, Mexico. And that afternoon, we were in the tiny town of Pátzcuaro in the central plaza where there was a Day of the Dead fair. And the streets were filled with people and with vendors, and the flowers were about 5 feet high in the streets. There were marigolds, which we have here, thanks to a friend's garden. And purple chicken's crest or something like that. Anyway, it's a purple flower. Calla lilies and baby's crest. Those are the four major flowers that are used. And people were buying items to decorate their home altars and also their family graves. They were buying incense, it's called copal, and candles of all kinds. There's the bread, the pan de muerto, and all sorts of other foods. And there was a woman named Margarita who was selling embroidery, and I bought this one, which is called Noche de Muertos, the Night of the Dead. Shows the cemetery scene with graves filled with flowers and candles. Well, after dinner, we went to the basilica in the town, and we heard a concert by the chorus and symphony of the State of Michoacan, and we heard Sanson's Danse Macabre, and then after that, Mozart's Requiem. And the experience of sitting in this ancient church with all of these Mexican families listening to Mozart's Requiem was really, really something. Then afterwards, and this is about 10:30 at night, we went by bus to another tiny little village called Pimutro. And in the village cemetery, there was just a blaze of candles and hundreds of people. And it was so unusual because it was at night, to be in a cemetery at night, lit by hundreds of candles was such an experience. And there were many candles around every grave. The graves were heaped with flowers. And around each grave were seated the family members. On stools, on blankets, they had food with them. They were talking, laughing. Children were playing. And it was such a contrast to cemeteries in the U.S. where you see an occasional person digging, putting in some flowers, or you might see a group of people for a funeral. But to be there at night with hundreds of people, it just brought forth this commonality of death and the evidence of strong family ties. It was just a very powerful experience. And in every home in this part of Mexico, there will be an altar, or they call it una ofrenda, and it might be with several tiers. There'll be bread and all sorts of fruits of the season, favorite food of the deceased, pictures of family members, items of clothing or their favorite books, and friends and neighbors come in and out, and go up, have some food, look at the items, talk with people about the people who have died. And these particular customs do not come from the Spanish, but they predate the Spanish. They're really part of the culture of the indigenous people. And in this area, they're the Parepecha Indians, which was part of the Tarascan Empire. And in any part of Mexico where there's a prevalence of an Indian culture, as in Oaxaca or Chiapas, you will have these customs. In the larger cities, you will not find them to this extent. One kind of interesting thing in Oaxaca is that the dead are invited to come by the ringing of church bells and by firecrackers. This had been a harvest festival in which the living invite the dead to come back for a day to participate. And so marigold leaves were strewn from the door of the house all the way to the family ofrenda to guide the spirit, to see the food, and they're invited to warm their bones by the fire for one day, to talk and to eat, and for the people to feel their presence. Then, after this visiting and so on, they accompany at night the spirits back to the cemetery, and they don't just leave there, as you heard in the children's story, but they stay all night long around the graves, celebrating and talking, eating, playing games, and so on. So when the Spanish came, bringing Catholicism, some intelligent priest noticed this and said, aha, we have All Souls Day and All Saints Day, November 1st and November 2nd. We'll just move these very nice customs to that time. So in Michoacan, people may go to Mass during this time, but the major celebrations are in the home and in the cemeteries. Now, in Mexico, at the same time, there's a lot of public celebration as well as in homes. And in every public building, there will be an ofrenda, usually to a national hero, or it might be to victims of a terremoto, an earthquake. And there's a lot of playing with death. We have something for Barbara, from Barbara.
The word death is not pronounced in New York, in Paris, in London, because it burns the lips. The Mexican, in contrast, is familiar with death, jokes about it, caresses it. It is one of his favorite toys and most steadfast love.
I wanted to show you this little papier-mâché object here that caught George's eye in San Miguel de Allende. It's a kind of caricature of a Mexican with his foot on a skull, and it has this unusual saying here, La Muerte me vale madre. And at the time, we knew madre was mother, and Muerte was death, but that was about the extent of it. We couldn't figure out what this was. Anyway, talking to people who were a little reticent about telling us what it really meant, turns out it's death is worth a mother, if you can just, to me. It's a kind of a little obscenity, and this is kind of a caricature, really, of the Mexican attitude towards death. And you'll find in Mexican art, in posters and engravings, a lot of use of the skeleton, much more so than in this country. The Chicano Farm Workers Theater in Chicago has a big poster with skeletons. There's a picture here of... This book is filled with skeletons, by the way. And here's one of them, mariachi band. And they have all sorts of little dioramas, miniature skeletons, kind of mimicking the foibles of humans in the land of the dead. There'll be popcorn salesmen and beauticians. And sometimes it maybe offend the sensibilities of the North Americanos and so on, but I found it quite refreshing, actually. And children in this culture are taught not to fear death. They are given every year these little candies, skulls, with their name on it, which they eat. They also have little candy coffins with figures in them to chop on, which was a very different sight for me. And when you strip away the belief system, of course, you're still left with a lot of wonderful humanistic kinds of things that are going on. I felt this culture has a kind of a built-in healing system for dealing with death. They see death not as an end of life, but as part of life. And you get the sense of the continuity of life when you see families around graves and you know that these people someday die, their descendants, the little kids, will be around these graves.
remembrances of the dead, too, are not private but shared with the community. And here's a culture who set aside 2 whole days for thinking about these things, and everyone is doing it. It's somewhat like the 4th of July, which everyone is involved in this. I think there are other cultures that do a better job than we do with remembrances. Certainly the Jewish culture is one where there's a yahrzeit candle lit on the anniversary of the death. And the family rises to pray Kaddish prayers in the synagogue. Or the Japanese have a very elaborate system of memorials. So that's why I'm standing here before you. I've come like the Ancient Mariner with a story to tell. And it was such a fantastic experience that I thought this would be something that we might use, that might become a part of our tradition. Okay. George and I are going to play a song from Peru.
This melody is called Vasija de Barro, which means the bar of clay or the clay pot. And the words of the song are, I want to be buried the way my ancestors have been buried, in a fresh clay pot. What they do in these native tribes is they would make a new large pot, put the body into the pot and bury the pot in the ground. And the words say, I want to be buried like my ancestors, and like the memory of me, I want to be as fresh as the clay in this pot.
Thank you.
bring up here any object, pictures, one by one, and light a candle at the end of it, right here. It might be easiest to light the candle by just putting it in the center. So, anyone want to be first?
For artists, image and object are often the same. This is a self-portrait by Lois. And as you didn't tell jokes, but this displays a sense of humor. This is a self-portrait taken before the window of a fashionable shop in Milwaukee. And there is Lois behind the in the window with what's rather dowdy, you know, flat shoes. Old sailor hat. It's a nice picture. You know, she likes herself, and she's sort of poking fun at the people who patronize these fancy shops. It's a nice way of remembering her.
Your Unitarian All Saints Day celebration, Dale. Alfred Leonard Gross. He had the quickest eye, hand, and wit of any he knew. His nimble body moved with the ease and grace of an unceremonious calf. He knew what he wanted to do, and it wasn't what his teachers expected. Some thought his words an artistic work, not his own. Losing interest in formal schooling, he welcomed the hospitality of Chippewa Indians and Finnish pioneers residing in the vast wilderness of northern Minnesota and Canada. He mastered their fishing, hunting, and trapping skills, and added others to their repertoire. His reputation spread to Minneapolis, Chicago, and Westwood. Wealthy sportsmen often at this time and gave him lavish gifts for leading them to prize trophies. A stunning string of trout, a record rack of antlers, a matchless wolf pelt. They marveled at how he could read nature's secret signs, and with a gesture tame a tavern, brawl a lumberjack. Then World War II hit us like a raging storm from hell. Arriving at Fort Snelling in moccasins, Army recruiters were confused by Glenn's talent. His father, a college psychologist, either guessed or heard or knew he topped their IQ ceiling. But knowing friends were not surprised when he served as commanding officer of Company A, 1st Rangers, each man an intrepid scout, jungle fighter, and expert rifleman. They tracked enemy movements and, when necessary, quickly engaged their fire. Surrounded in the Black Forest, they foraged the wild game while steadily shadowing enemy positions. His family, fiancé, and friends were jubilant when, at war's end, he returned home. His fatally ill father laughed uncontrollably at his swift humor and betrayal of Robert Service's poetry. Year in hand, Glenn and his fiancée Bertha joyfully journeyed to the mysterious land of his early years. But the glowing future he hoped they would have took a terrible turn when shortly thereafter he was killed in a car accident. Mourners came from afar to his funeral and burial on a wintry November day, blanketed by darkly veiled skies. As he was placed in the stone earth, he was shaken by the cries of utter despair from his never-to-be bride. Echoes of the forlorn grief had scarcely drifted away in a gaggle of clamoring feet with the somber air. Their nodding breaths and flapping wings seemed to be bidding goodbye to Glenn's daunting spirit. Bertha joined the widow circle, never married, and died a heart failure in her 50s. Images of what Glenn's future could have brought to those he touched have haunted me for more than half a century. His death at 31 erased the identity and deeds of all who might have been born from his union with Bertha. Still in this sad world, no one escaped the offer-giving finality of destiny's design. By venturing with ardor and sparkle to the outer edges of the unknown, Glenn inspired his comrades to quicken the larger meaning of their living and meaning. Llewellyn Gross, October 30th, 1998. And I have two things to share. Glenn did on his fly, flying a book
goes fishing. There's a lot of them up there. Afterwards, we'll look at them, but I also have some pictures of what they see. And any questions you'd like to ask or comments, I will relay them to my father.
Yes, would you like to let him?
I've been on a very joyful adventure this last week. I've been studying historical notes that my father and his brother left. And they're about both my grandmother and my grandfather. But they're from the boy's perspective and their son's perspective. And I want to think about my grandmother more. And so I've been studying the notes and the same material. In the perspective of a woman, there's my grandmother in the wedding dress. Here, just peeking out from under the dress. He was not expecting to live long. That's the man. We both did quite a bit. And Yolita, would you like to? While I was preparing for this, I noticed this picture of my mother, and I thought I should say something about my mother. She was really kind of calling out to me. And I'm so appreciative not only of her care in my upbringing, but also in her coming each time one of our four children was born and doing all the work that has to be done at that time. And I can't think of the mountain of clothes that she ironed, socks that were repaired, casseroles made, and so on. And one of the last things she did was to make us pistachios.
She really wasn't a crocheter like she
was well to this, and she noticed the colors that were in our living room and made this for us. So, great storyteller, but he wasn't very articulate about how he felt about me. The only time he told me he loved me was shortly before he died. And his passion was being out on the lake, on the water, fishing. He left me one of his poles. And it was sort of a joke around the house that he was inept with a lot of regular household repairs. My mother repaired the rug, she did the rewiring. But he always kept his poles in perfect condition. He oiled up, he tied his own flies, he'd make his own sinkers, pouring molten lead. In fact, there's a funny story. Once he did attempt one household repair, in fact, he completed it, there was a depression in the floor of the bathroom. It was like he would step down into it. It was pretty bothersome. So my mother asked him to do something about it. And what he did was that he poured molten lead in it, and it leveled out just fine. So we had this big, shiny, you know, gray spot in the bathroom floor. Bottom picture is the only picture we have of him in his boat, and I'm glad that we took it.
If he had been able, he had been more articulate about his emotions, I think he would have written things along the lines of North Country Notebook, if you've ever read sections from that. He had a real feel for wildness and for nature. And people came, and I found out more about that part of him, that side of him after his death, than I knew when he was alive. But he couldn't speak about it to us, but friends of his that he could share these experiences with told us about them later. And I know that he found his peace in life out on the water and out in the woods.
Say a few words in memory of my father. Shortly after my father died, age 58 of cancer, my mother told me, "George, you'll never know what my father has gone through." My father was raised in a little town in Russia. There were four kids in the family. His mother died when he was 8, and his father remarried and brought 5 new children into the family. The stepmother was the original wicked witch of the East, and she just hated the 4 siblings of my father, and she tormented them. At one time, she chased my father's older brother, Joseph, up to the roof and pushed him down, and he was a cripple all his life until he wound up in a mass grave thanks to the Nazis who came to his collective farm. When my father was 11 years of age, he couldn't take his stepmother anymore, and at 11 he ran away from home, and as he was walking along the road, a wagon drew up, and a young couple who were escaping from Tsarist Russia picked him up and took him to town. The young couple, the man, was a shoemaker, and my father learned the shoemaker's trade. When he came to this country in 1914, he was a laster, a shoemaker, that is working in a factory producing shoes. Now here is a shoe jack the type to use to work on your shoes. You take the shoe off, slip it on here, and just pound it and sell it. And my father's early life was sort of like a Horatio Alger story. He started off as a relatively unskilled shoe worker. Then he became a skilled shoe worker, then he became a foreman, then he became a part owner in a rather prosperous ladies' shoe company, which went belly up during the Depression. And from then on, his life was Horatio Alger in reverse. I don't know whether we have a word for it. Just before he died, he went to the union, the shoe and leather workers union, to apply for a job. Who should be sitting behind the desk to hire him but a gentleman called Fred Peterson,
who was a communist, who had organized a strike in my father's shop many years ago. And here my father came, and the strike was lost. And here my father came begging the Fred Wiesenkamp for a job. My father just turned around and felt so ashamed and went home. And he died rather penniless. And that's fact, in many ways, I support my family. So here's a picture of my father and mother and I. This took place when they were on vacation in Miami. I was a GI at the time, visiting them in Miami. And he's really a wonderful. He's a great father.
Grandmother's bookcase that's about this tall. I did bring my mother's ring. This is one of the things that I got when we were doing had jewelry. And it was kind of interesting because it had tape on her because she'd lost a lot of weight. So it didn't fit on this finger, it fit on this finger. And I thought about taking off the tape, but I didn't want it to be next to her. So I let the tape wear off and wore it. Wear off until it felt like, okay, we're down to the strings now, it's time to take it off, make it fit on my finger instead of the finger that would fit hers on. I'm kind of up here for my three parents. I had a father, I had a mother, and I had a great-grandmother who lived with us when I was born, and she was kind of the one that helped raise me until she died at 4 and a half. And some of the gifts that they gave me, I kind of carried with me. So that's kind of what I'm bringing with me today. My grandmother left me a good sense of where the ground is and a wonderful sense of bizarre humor that has helped me through more occasions than I can fancy. I wasn't very happy home sometimes. And I was very unhappy during college. And I was like thinking about, I was in the bathroom someplace on campus thinking about how, you know, I had to tell myself I was utterly miserable. So I was going to make them out my will. Well, what did I have in there to write on? I had the paper towel. So I'm taking a paper towel, and I'm going to write my will. And I'm starting to realize that I have absolutely nothing to leave to anybody. And I'm going, well, I guess I can't die yet. I don't even have anything to leave to anybody, so I guess I'll have to hang around Wilder. And that sense of humor, once I thought that, was like, it, you know, the thought of killing myself was like silly. And so that sense of humor of hers, that sense of the ridiculousness of lying, really has helped me through a couple of spots. And for my father, I got a sense of, he had a sense of life, joy, even though he had been very abused when he was younger. He never lost that sense, and he never lost the sense of looking at us and like wondering where these astounding creatures came from. And he always had that sense of him. It's really nice to be considered an astounding creature that he just couldn't imagine the marvelousness of this thing. Boy. You know, and so he always had that sense of, there was a sense of pride and marvelousness about his children. And which helped too. Then there was my mother. My mother I did not get along with for the first 45 years of my life, probably. It became a duty to call her. But it was interesting. We managed to work it out before she died. It was really interesting. And I give her a lot of credit for that. She was a doer. And if I could bring one thing, I would probably bring the boats or the quilted jacket that she made that I had sitting in my dining room at home that I get to look at, because it felt like I lost her a little too soon. Just when we were working things out, just when we were getting it straight. So she was a doer. She really liked to do things. And I like to think, like, even though she was very sick during the last year, she did. She taught. She finally got through. And we finally worked out so that I told her at one point, I said, I can feel your love from the top of my head to down to my feet. There's nothing, you know, and there was nothing more to say. There was just, we'd said what we needed to. And I actually found, I went from going to feeling about her like, well, I haven't called her for 3 months, I guess I'd better, to calling her every day and enjoying it. But still, I find it something of a miracle to actually, you know, go from that moment to another. So, this is kind of for my three parents. My mother died in November 4th, so it's almost a year. And I kind of miss my parents, but they're kind of still with me.
Well, mine died 8 months ago, my husband. And I brought this box. It was something that my children bought me for my birthday. My birthday happened soon after my died, and I wanted to make him a part of it in some way, and I wanted to help my kids too. So I asked them if they would buy something that we could put some of the ashes in and keep at home. I wanted them to go out together and do it together. I wanted them to have breakfast and lunch together. And my idea was that this would bring them together to talk about their feelings about me being present. And it would bring my hand to my birthday. So this is what they came back with. They gave it to me. Brian said that it reminded them of mine because of how it was made of natural material over the course of 7 days. And I was thinking about how the box and the characteristics of the box remind me of life for me in a good way, if I say simple, I mean something closer to purity. Now, I don't know, but I think that the essence of all of us is probably love and some other really good things. And I saw all that in my, I think the quality that stood out the most to me was his acceptance. He didn't resist life. He accepted whatever occurred. He didn't fight it. And when he was faced with the final challenge, which was his dying, he faced that as well. I think that's what got us all through that. I remember the very day he was diagnosed with cancer, he didn't even know what kind he had. He told us that if he had to die, that was okay. He'd done most of what he wanted to do in his life. And that's just what we want.
And Simon got a picture too.
Actually,
wanted to remember my sister and say a few words about her. She wore her heart on her sleeve, in contrast to my dad. And they are very close. I think they complimented each other. And this is her billfold, her wallet. I couldn't bear to empty it out. It has her driver's license, her nurse's. She worked at a hospital. Things from her life. She always said the things that we kind of tiptoed around. She wasn't afraid to speak what was on her mind and in her heart. An anecdote about her is when our younger brother became sexually active, she was the one who sat down and talked to him about birth control act and what he was using and what he should do about it. She was right there. And I wanted to bring her sewing machine, but I didn't. She was very creative and she lived her life very well.
If anyone, too, would like to just come up and light a candle for someone without saying anything, that's fine, too.
If I will just light a candle, I don't, but I would like to say something. I don't have anything to leave for this particular individual who died just about 2 weeks ago, who's a cousin of my mother's named Charlie Justice. I did not know this person very well, but he was always a presence in my life. Charlie was a very interesting person. He never went to college, but he was one of the most educated people I ever knew. He was self-taught in almost everything that he did, which is an inspiration to me, having been self-taught in my own profession. He was a genealogist, and he taught me things about my mother's side of the family that were very fascinating, and the things that I take with me daily. So I want to honor Charlie Justice's memory. He put the town of Blowing Rock, North Carolina, on the map for me.
On this day in 1980, our daughter Laura died. She was 1 day old. This is her hand. That's the bad news. But thanks to Lisa. Of course, we have Brian together.
This is our son, John Gardner Dorney. He died 9 years ago. Well, you know him as a boy, a teenager. And this is a little baby. He's not going.
Green candle is because being young was very important to him, and maybe Ruth can explain this because I can't get through it. At his memorial service here, he played a song called Forever Young, and I think Ruth can tell you it's a quote you gave me from your able ones in the service.
The quote had to do with someone who lost a child. And the parent said, he will always be young and always be ours. Maybe it would be best in interest of time for people to come up after the service and light a candle for someone if they would like. Rachel, do you want to come? We wanted to just mention the names of prairie members who have died in the past, and if they haven't been mentioned before, I'll light a candle for them.
Okay. Rand Cotley, Rowan Parrish, Avis Parrish, Bill Caldwell, Lois Hagstrom, Betsy Roberts, Rebecca Clark, Les Lyons, Dorothy Weatherby, John Dorney, John Grant Nod. Myra Werfel. Carol Dopp. And Mike Sheehan.
Rachel, 2 days ago, Jane Wilkening died.
Oh, is that one?
Precious memory. Remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to love mightily, and to bow to the mystery. We invite people to come up, especially those who have spoken about someone, and to be greeted by the rest of the congregation, to look at the objects that are here, to have some pan de muertos. Thank you all very much for coming. And we're going to reenact. We're in a house in Mexico.